Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are accelerating straight into, well, the real cutting edge of decentralized finance.
We really are.
We're looking at a protocol that has basically set a new standard. It's achieving this institutional-grade trading performance.
The kind of speed you'd only see on a huge CEX, like a Binance or a Bybit.
Exactly. But it's all happening in a fully decentralized, non-custodial environment.
And that protocol is Hyperliquid. It's a layer one blockchain that was custom built from the ground up, what we call vertically integrated. And it's made for one thing, high frequency perpetuals trading.
So our mission today really is to dig into the material you sent over. That's lesson five on the L1 performance and the practical steps in exercise five, and answer one core question.
Yeah, the big one.
How did they pull it off? How did they get these just, I mean, mind bending numbers like 0.2 second latency, 200,000 orders per second? And what are the trade-offs? What are the risks hiding in that architecture?
Well, what's so fascinating here is that they didn't just build an app on top of, you know, Ethereum or another L2. They built the chain itself from first principles. They designed the whole thing, consensus and all, just for a central limit order book.
That's a huge undertaking.
It is. And it's a paradigm shift because they sliced away all the latency that comes from having all those different layers of abstraction.
Okay, so let's unpack that engineering challenge first. How on earth do you go from a standard layer one block, time, say, Ethereum's 12 seconds, all the way down to 0.2 seconds end to end? I mean, that's a 60x improvement. Where'd they find all that speed?
They found it right at the foundation in the consensus mechanism. They essentially threw out the traditional models and developed their own thing called Hyper-BFT.
Hyper-BFT, okay.
It's a highly optimized version of a protocol called Hot Stuff. And the key innovation, the real magic bullet, is something called pipeline consensus.
Pipeline consensus.
Yeah.
That sounds like they're running things at the same time instead of one after the other.
That's exactly right. Think about traditional consensus. It's like an assembly line where you have to wait for one car to be completely finished, painted, and out the door.
Right.
Before the next one can even start. Validators have to wait for block N to be totally finalized before they can even propose block N plus one. It's sequential, it's safe, but it's slow.
So you've got all this dead time, this idle time between blocks.
Precisely. Hyper-BFT's pipelining lets validators propose block N plus one while block N is still in the final voting stages. They're processing blocks in parallel. You don't wait for the previous batch to finish.
And that parallelization must be where that massive throughput comes from.
That's how you get to 200,000 orders per second.
Yeah, and that capacity, that number isn't just marketing fluff. For a market maker, that kind of sub-second latency is, well, it's everything. It's non-negotiable.
It's the difference between being profitable and, you know, getting killed by toxic flow. But the speed doesn't just come from consensus. It's also about what's running on top of it. And that leads us right to their big architectural choice, the dual state architecture.
Okay, so we said they built the chain from scratch. Why then split it into two layers, HyperCore and HyperEVM, if they're using the same validators? What's the point?
Oh, that split is absolutely essential. Imagine trying to run a complex yield vault calculation or a big governance vote on the same machine that's trying to match trades in milliseconds.
It would just grind to a halt. The trading engine would get clogged up.
Totally. So they compartmentalize, they put all the time-sensitive stuff in one place and everything else in another.
So tell us about the speed demon layer, HyperCore.
So HyperCore is the specialized trading state. It runs the entire order book, the CLB, the margin engine, the liquidation logic. And crucially, all of it is written in native Rust code.
Not Solidity.
Not Solidity. And that's where the critical performance gain comes from.
Right. Because the usual critique of on-chain exchanges is that every little thing, placing an order, canceling an order, it all has to run through the EVM with gas metering and state updates and all that slow baggage.
Exactly. The EVM is interpreting code, kind of like Java. HyperCore is running native Rust, which is compiled directly to machine code. The performance difference is just, it's night and day.
And they strip out all the unnecessary stuff.
Everything. No gas metering for orders, no complex state updates. The order matching itself becomes a native primitive of the chain.
That's a huge commitment, though.
Mm.
Building in native Rust gives you that speed. But what about security? What about audits? If you're not using the battle-tested EVM, doesn't that make things harder?
That's a real trade-off. You're absolutely right. It puts a much bigger burden on the developers and validators to make sure that core logic is perfect. They do open source it, which helps. But the benefit is that every single order is fully on-chain and verifiable without the performance hit you'd get anywhere else.
So HyperCore is for the lightning-fast trading. HyperEVM handles everything else. How do they stop, say, a huge NFT mint on HyperEVM from slowing down the whole network?
They use a really clever trick inside HyperEVM called a dual block architecture. They have fast blocks happening like every second with a really low gas limit.
Perfect for simple token transfers.
Right. And then they have slow blocks, maybe once a minute, that are much, much bigger and can handle all the heavy, complex stuff. It ensures the trading engine never gets choked.
And how do they talk to each other? How does a contract on the slow layer know the real-time price from the fast layer?
Through something called read precompiles. It's basically an embedded function. A smart contract on HyperEVM can just instantly query the state of HyperCore price, funding rate, whatever, without needing an oracle or some slow messaging system.
So you get atomic composability. Wow.
Exactly. It's a really tight coupling.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for the listener who actually wants to trade the zero gas model. What does that actually mean for an active trader, and how does it change the whole market?
The zero gas benefit is it's transformational for anyone doing active trading or market making. You pay zero gas for placing an order, for canceling an order, for modifying an order. You only pay a fee when it actually executes.
That's huge. I mean, I've been there. You're on an Ethereum CLOB. The market moves against you and you have to cancel and resubmit your bid. That could be, what, 20, 50 bucks in gas fees if it's busy?
Oh, absolutely. That cost to cancel is brutal on other chains. It forces market makers to use really wide spreads just to cover that friction. Hyperliquid just gets rid of it.
And when you remove that cost of managing your risk,
market makers can quote much tighter spreads. And tighter spreads mean deeper liquidity and better prices for every single trader on the platform. It benefits everyone.
Okay, but then the classic question, if there's no gas fee, what stops a malicious user from just spamming the order book with millions of useless orders and grinding the system to a halt anyway?
Right, the Sybil resistance problem. They substitute gas with a really sophisticated rate limiting system. Some people call it a pay-to-play model.
So what are the levers they're pulling?
Well, the first layer is volume-based rate limiting. Your ability to submit orders is tied directly to how much you've traded. Roughly one request per one USDC traded.
So if you haven't traded much, you have a tiny little buffer, and if you try to spam, you'll burn through it instantly.
Instantly. You're throttled. The other layer is stake-weighted priority. During, you know, crazy volatility when everyone is trying to get orders in,
right.
Priority doesn't go to whoever pays the most gas. It goes to users who are staking the HYPE token or who pay for dedicated request weight.
That is such a crucial difference. So instead of fighting a gas war that just makes miners rich, you're either rewarded for providing value to the protocol or you're paying the protocol directly for bandwidth.
Exactly.
This leads us perfectly into the liquidity itself, the HLP vault. It's unique, but it's also been, well, it's been at the center of some really serious incidents.
The HLP vault is the heart of Hyperliquid's liquidity. It does two main things. It's an automated market maker, so it's algorithmically placing bids and asks on the order book, and it's also the liquidation backstop for the whole exchange.
What kind of strategy does it use? Is it just passive?
No, it's an active vault. It takes on directional risk, but it tries to manage that using something called inventory skew.
Okay, explain that.
So let's say a ton of traders are going long Bitcoin, so they're buying from the vault. The vault's inventory is now heavily short Bitcoin.
Right, it's unbalanced.
It's unbalanced. Mm. So to rebalance, the algorithm automatically changes its quotes. It'll make it less attractive for people to keep buying from it, and it'll tighten the ask spread to make it cheaper for people to sell back to it. It's trying to incentivize the market to bring it back to neutral.
And it's been wildly successful. The data you sent shows fees exploding from under $300K in late 2024 to over $7 million in 2025. The returns look amazing.
They do. The Sharpe ratio went from about 2.9 up to 5.2, which is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But like you said, you can't just look at the good times. You have to look at the failures because that's where you see the real risk.
Let's get into those, the two big ones. Popcat and Jelly, what happened?
So the Popcat incident in November 2025 was a masterclass in how to manipulate an algorithm. An attacker basically studied how the HLP algo reacted to market pressure.
Oh, hey.
And then they systematically placed a massive buy wall, a giant order, at one price, which the HLP algorithm saw as extreme, genuine, bullish demand.
So the HLP saw the wall and thought, the market is rocketing up. I need to get short against this wave.
Precisely. It aggressively started opening huge short positions, thinking it was providing liquidity to a real trend. And once HLP was fully positioned, massively short, the attacker just pulled the buy wall.
Poof. the price signals vanishes.
It vanished, and the real market price collapsed instantly. HLP was left holding a $4.9 million loss because its algorithm was tricked into taking a catastrophic trade.
A brutal lesson. But the Jelly incident was maybe even more important for what it says about the protocol's governance.
It was. The Jelly incident involved a whale creating a huge amount of bad debt. Over $4 million that threatened the solvency of the entire HLP vault. It was a crisis.
And the fix wasn't algorithmic, was it?
It was not. And this is the critical point for anyone listening. The crisis was only stopped when the Hyperliquid validators executed an Oracle override.
So they stepped in.
They stepped in. The validators used their collective power to manually intervene, halt liquidations, and adjust the price feed to stop the system from imploding.
Which means that for all the on-chain tech and all the speed, when things go really wrong, the safety net is human. It's a group of validators making a decision. That's a huge departure from the code is law ideal.
It introduces what we call a social consensus layer. It means Hyperliquid isn't purely trustless. You're placing trust in the validator set, knowing that they have the power and have already used it, to manually change the state of the chain. It puts it squarely in that C-DeFi category.
That context is so important. Okay, let's switch to the practical side. If you want to get set up on Hyperliquid, what's the process and what are the key risks to watch out for?
It's a two-step process. First, you need your MetaMask wallet, and you need it configured for the Arbitrum network. Second, you deposit funds, which means bridging USDCE from Arbitrum over to the Hyperliquid L1.
And that bridge is the first major point of trust, right?
Absolutely. When you bridge, your funds are locked in a contract controlled by a multi-sig wallet. That's a group of, say, 5 to 9 trusted signers. They are the custodians of those bridged assets. If they were ever compromised or colluded,
your funds are gone.
That's the primary custody risk, is to get onto the chain.
Okay, so your funds are on the L1. Then the platform asks you to sign an enable trading message. This creates session keys. What are those, and why are they both a huge convenience and a potential risk?
Session keys are basically temporary, limited power keys stored locally in your browser. The huge advantage is speed. Because you're signing every order with the session key, not your main wallet, you get one-click trading. There's no wallet pop-up for every single action.
Which you absolutely need for high-frequency trading. Waiting for MetaMask would just kill the whole point.
It would. But the flip side is security. Those keys are stored locally in your browser. If your device gets compromised with malware, those keys could potentially be accessed. So you have to be really diligent about knowing how to revoke them if you suspect anything is wrong.
So if we pull back and look at the whole package, the custom consensus, the Rust engine, Zero Gas, the CLOB, who is this platform actually built for?
It's engineered for active traders, high volume scalpers, and professional market makers. It gives them the tools and the speed to run strategies that were just impossible in DeFi before. It gives them CEX performance without giving up custody.
That was a powerful look inside Hyperliquid. We've covered the HyperBFT pipeline that gives it that incredible speed, the dual state architecture, the zero gas model.
And we spent a lot of time on the HLP vault and its risks, especially from the Popcat and Jelly incidents. The main takeaway is that while the architecture is fast and transparent, you have to be aware of the trust points, the bridge, your session keys, and most importantly, the power of the validators.
And that brings us to our final provocative thought for you to chew on. The Jelly incident showed that during a catastrophe, the validators use their social consensus layer to save the protocol. So if the goal of DeFi is to be completely trustless, what is the optimal balance between that pure, unyielding code is law philosophy and a necessary social consensus layer that can step in during a black swan event to save everyone's funds?
That is the central tension in DeFi right now. It's something you have to keep front of mind as you explore these systems.
Until next time. Keep digging deeper.